Okay, so my name is Marian Morris. I'm a doctoral student and teaching assistant at the UT Austin School of Nursing. But I think of myself as a public health professional because that's where I kind of started out. I'm a newer nurse and an older public health person. I'm sharing a case study I did about a year ago. So my research interest is learning more about how people think about the idea of mental illness. So that's how this is approaching this topic. I feel like I understand why I'm here, but I didn't go into this studying stigma, so it was interesting to me that I ended up on this panel. I have no disclosures, and I did want to just acknowledge here my participant for his willingness and openness, and my faculty advisor, Dr. Tracy Harrison at the University of Texas at Austin, and a colleague, Chris Divin Cosgrove, who's a family nurse practitioner in Austin. So just looking, the problem I'm interested in is that there seem to be more and more children and younger children who are being diagnosed with mental illness. A recent study in August from Olson and colleagues described doctor visits where there was an antipsychotic prescription involved for children and looked at two periods in the mid-1990s and 2005 to 2009 and found a sevenfold increase in those visits and a fourfold increase for adolescents. And on the one hand, you know, I can't say I know exactly what's happening with that. If there is more mental illness happening, is it good that we're paying more attention? If there is more mental illness, is it that? Is it that there's a narrowing of the spectrum of normality? And another question I really have is, which I hope to try to figure out how to study at some point, is are children who enter the mental health care system better off than children who are not entering the mental health care system? So, and my particular theoretical and philosophical approach here is specifically not sort of from that mind-body dualistic approach. George Engel in the 1970s was talking about his biopsychosocial model, where you have to take into consideration the biological, the psychological, the social in determining illness and health. And more recently, Dan Siegel is a psychiatrist who is espousing this theory of interpersonal neurobiology, where the environment has to be included in the model of health and illness. And I've been exploring sort of neurophilosophy, and the questions that they ask in that arena make me realize, you know, how little I feel like we still really understand about mental health and mental illness. You know, how much are feelings tied to biology, and why do we have emotions? How do you reconcile causality with beliefs and attitudes? How much choice is there about how we have emotions? Can we use our minds to change our brains? I think these are all what we're trying to explore. So my particular study design for this was constructionist, that how we know what we know is through conscious stated experience. The theoretical approach is interpretivist. So seeking understanding rather than causality, although I do catch myself at times trying to explore causality, and you may hear that some in what I'm talking about. And my particular methodological approach for this was ethnographic, and specifically using Norman Denzin's interpretive interactionism, especially because he uses this idea of epiphanies or pivotal moments, where experiences leave long-lasting, permanent effects on a person's sense of themselves and the world. And so it seemed very useful for eliciting a parent's thoughts about the pivotal moment of receiving a diagnosis of mental illness for his child, and how that moment shaped the child's idea, the parent's idea of mental illness, and the people around them and the wider social networks. So I did purposeful sampling to find a parent who lived within reach of me, spoke English, could meet with me for up to 3 interviews, and was parenting a child who had been diagnosed with one or more of 4 conditions within the last 2 years. The conditions I chose were conduct disorder, ADHD, depression, or bipolar disorder. And the main reason I chose them was because they were commonly occurring diagnoses. So it was convenience. And I supplemented Jensen's process with some coding methods, holistic coding to try to find those moments of epiphany, and then emotions and values coding to try to draw out those pieces of his discussion. I also used field notes and demographic information to try to provide context, but tried to use them so as to avoid identifying him and his family. I taped and transcribed interviews and then did several reading passes for the analysis. So I'm calling him Joe. He was one of three people who contacted me, and the two others had diagnoses that I hadn't included or were diagnosed further in the past than 2 years from when they contacted me. Their children, excuse me. So my one participant was named Joe, and I did two interviews with him a year ago in the fall. He and his wife were in their 40s. They had grown up in the Midwest, moved to the East Coast, and then came to Austin. They are white, middle class, white collar. They received several diagnoses for their son. They had visited a couple of therapists and a neurologist. And in the course of all that, had been told that what might be going on could be attachment disorder, bipolar disorder, ADHD, a mood disorder, or a low-grade autism, or possibly some co-occurrence of those things. And in the 2 years prior to the interview, his son had entered and left kindergarten in public school because he had started damaging classrooms and was violent towards teachers. They had tried a charter school, then homeschooling, which had a group component to it, then a private school, which had a therapy component, and this was covered by health insurance, which definitely factored into how they conceived of what was going on and how they decided to try to handle it. And he shared a clear moment of epiphany that I'll share with you, and then these five themes from the analytic process. So I've given this presentation a couple of times, and the first couple of times I put the quotes up on the screen and then read them. And I was told to try not putting the quotes up and just reading them to you. So if anyone wants to give me some feedback about how that is, please let me know. But I'm going to read you some quotes from the interviews. So here's the first quote. And I should contextualize this too. He was a great interviewee, and really good at self-reflection. And his quotes, I want to make sure that I try to relate if I can't do it with my own voice. His tone was this very sweet combination of sadness and irony, and he used a lot of humor to get himself through him and his family through the situation. So here's the first quote. I think that was kind of like the big moment. I sort of realized, because I hadn't started chaperoning him then, that's when I finally saw him in the school environment and how miserable he was, and I couldn't. I mean, I was partially sympathetic to him, but I was also partially, like, you know, kind of mad and stuff, too. I mean, I didn't say anything there. I was all, you know, but I had all these conflicted emotions, and that's when I came home and explained everything to his wife. She was kind of the one who said, "Are we finally?" And I don't know if we had poo-pooed therapy or if we had really acknowledged it to each other. I think maybe she had brought it up offhandedly a few times, and it was like, "No, no, no." And then she said, "Are we finally going to bite the bullet and do a therapist?" And I said, "Yeah." So this was this moment in kindergarten when he watched what a hard time his son was having, and he sort of completely reoriented in that moment to the problem that was going on. And when he, I think before this all started to happen, before they entered school, thank you, I think he really had an idea more kind of in the nature versus nurture arguments. He was definitely more on the sort of nurture end of things. So the first theme that came out was how important peers were in sort of portraying, contextualizing what was going on. Here's a quote, another quote from him. "We knew all these other parents and kids, and everybody seemed to be, you know, on the same wavelength and everything. But then we kind of slowly, you know, after a while, we were kind of like the parents who always had to leave the party early. We're kind of used now to just being on our own little island." So they started to go through this experience of really profound isolation. And it was the people around them, it was the settings around them that seemed to signal acceptance, that seemed to signal whether or not there was normality going on or not. And it really brought up the question for me of what do we do with impulse and anger and violence in our kids. The next theme was ambivalence. He says, even though we're kind of like getting more answers, I'm still nervous about not just where we're going, but then also how much these people can really help us, I guess. But yeah, I mean, everybody's helped us a little bit along the way at least. So anyway, I don't know. So that's all my ambivalence right there, I guess. And as we've gotten into it, every time we've gone to somebody, I just hope that, I mean, when we finally broke down to see the first therapist, I was like, well, we're doing this, so, you know, he better get fixed. So the ambivalence sort of signaled to me that it seemed like he was being almost forced through a behavior change process. Ambivalence is something that you work a lot with in motivational interviewing, and so when that came out, I thought, okay, like, it seems like that's a lot of what's going on. His ideas of how mental illness works really changed. I neglected to mention earlier this his 7-year-old son, who was diagnosed with these things, was adopted as an infant. And he, let me read you this quote. "The reason we were interested in the attachment therapy is because he got separated from his mother after about a month. And when he was born, he had what could have been trauma. And we were in denial about this, sort of. We didn't think it would really affect him that deeply because it was only, you know, we were like, it happened when he was a month old. And then we were kind of, if we just love him enough, everything will be okay. We kind of realized that even in the womb, kids can be affected by things. And his mother had a very stressful pregnancy. I mean, we've met her and know her and stuff. We know that she had an incredibly stressful pregnancy. And even that, you know, could kind of affect brain development and everything." So he resisted what was going on to a point for a while because he didn't want his son's adopted status to be allowed to discount his closeness and his commitment to his son. So he resisted for a long time accepting this diagnosis and this portrayal of what was going on for them. And he also started to describe how the process of going through therapy started to be for him as much as for his son. And so his own ideas of his own mental health were changing along the way with his son. So the systems, the two main systems that really started to play a big role here were the school system and the mental health care system as he started to explore therapy and neurology. Thank you. And here's one more quote from a school counselor. At one point, the school counselor said that, you know, he was doing better, but she thought that he was kind of using me as a crutch too much. So maybe it was time for me to pull back a little bit. And so I told him that. I said, hey, I was trying to, like, be positive. Like, you're doing so well. I may not have to be there quite as much. And so he totally freaked out. And so badly that we got kicked out the next day. So he really, any one person in the system, there's good intentions, and at the same time, the systems sort of pushed the situation along in this way, you know, portraying a parent as a crutch, and really immediately leading to this undesired result of expulsion from the system. He also, in the course of this, he started exploring special education for his son and really had to change his whole ideas around about what was meant by special education as he came to learn about individualized education plans. He started to think, like, these sound actually pretty good, and why don't why doesn't every kid have an individualized education plan? I don't know how practical that is, but that sort of became his perspective. And then as he got into the mental health care system, more and more those two systems were representing the situation in such different ways that there was this very inconsistent and fragmented narrative going on. The final theme is just coming to this new place, a new paradigm for himself. He said it's been this progression of acceptance. First it was like, we can do it ourselves. Then it was like, we can do it with the help of a therapist. Now we're at the point where we're going to need us, him, a therapist, and drugs probably. And then, because in that year and a half with the homeschooling, that's when we realized the problems go deeper. So just to kind of wrap this up, he goes through this initial isolation, has a lot of ambivalence, reevaluates his and his son's situation, comes to this new place where he accepts that there's more complexity and maybe less control than he thought. And it all seemed very contingent on stepping outside this accepted range of behavior. And just to try and sort of contextualize it, you know, his case, it's both an exception because there definitely are people who get a diagnosis and treatment and it seems to work for them and things go fine. And there's also plenty of affirmation of his case in the research literature. And it's not just for Joe and his son that this seems to happen, but, you know, the people around him, the neighbors, the friends, the schools, the mental health care providers is how this seems to get built. And it also made me think a lot about just the new information that has come out in the last, you know, 12 years or so about the effect of adverse childhood experiences, the strong correlations with increased morbidity, earlier mortality, and then this whole new area of epigenetics that seems to be developing where what it looks like is that our genes interplay with the environment and that it's not just that we're set up and this is what we have, but that here's what we have and it's expressed or suppressed by what happens around us. And so it seems to fit within Joe's kind of newer ideas of what's going on for his son to say that he kind of got set up early for a stressful environment, came out, it's not a best fit, he gets described as mentally ill. And so, and this last slide is even, I'm not here anymore. it seems both like, in terms of public health, that it's even more important to think about the first years of life and how we're setting ourselves up for health or illness throughout our lives. And at the same time, we're also discovering that there is this plasticity and this ability to possibly recover from the hurts, from the insults that happen early on. So I don't have a solid conclusion for you, but that's it. Thank you.
Providers also refer to as a reason why they wanted to keep the label quiet. When I talked to the insurance agent, are the family of people. There are a couple programs. There's one based in Southern California, actually, that trains family members in leading support groups. And it's not just support, but therapy. And they've shown that actually a family member with someone who's been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder can affect similar treatment outcomes as a provider-led group. And so there are family members involved in that arena. There's family members involved in the New York City area where they have activist organizations. Those are specifically focused on parents who have a child with borderline personality disorder. But historically, providers believed that people with borderline personality disorder were women. And despite the fact that they're described as being sexually promiscuous and impulsive, the consensus was that none of them had children and they had no family. We are only just beginning to get data that shows that obviously it would be illogical if there were many families and so on.
So you picked borderline personality disorder versus paranoid schizophrenia for a reason, I'm guessing.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of stigma around that.
Yes.
So the question that comes to mind is, and this wasn't really part of the study, but it's kind of tangential to it, is on the street, there is, I think, an understanding that therapists will use that label when they're not sure what to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that has something to do with the self-stigma that they have around not being able to help someone manage those symptoms.
Right.
That somehow interplays. I mean, it's not part of the study, but it just kind of went there.
That's another piece of what we looked at, the stigma in that regard, and where the stigma comes from. And we made kind of a structural argument that the stigma comes from not just that these behaviors are difficult, because providers will say that getting a chair thrown at you by a schizophrenic is not as upsetting as getting a chair thrown at you by someone with borderline personality disorder. Because somebody with borderline personality disorder knows better. Somebody with schizophrenia is sick. So there's this distinction there. And so there's this, when you push at them more and more, that it's not that they dislike borderline patients more because they are actually more difficult. The most popular explanation is this countertransference thing, that the patients actually make providers themselves feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I would say it goes one step further. It has to do with the provider's sense of competence. And I think that sense of competence is linked to the fact that we don't have enough treatment facilities, we don't have training, and so on. It would be very difficult for a provider to feel confident with this group.
And the intervention that's a good match for many people with this set of symptoms is DBT, which mm-hmm. these providers aren't trained in. So
some of them
very
are.
Very clever. They were?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
To follow up on that point, but mm-hmm. were you able to determine whether the adequately trained providers were the ones who were straight up about the diagnosis? It seems to me like that would be an important point.
The more adequately trained providers did not dislike their patients.
But did they share the diagnosis? Were they the people who shared?
Not necessarily, no, because some of them still had the same concerns about, someone who's a huge activist in the field was the one who said, I use regulation disorder. No, we don't have a study on it, but I use it anyway. I think it's better. So that didn't necessarily map onto communication strategies. Yes?
Thank you all for some interesting presentations. My question is actually with respect to the speaker resolution. So to me, the message about the spruce tree was so neutral that I'm wondering, because depression isn't really a happy construct, that maybe people were just saying felt more negative because of the word depression. And I was curious what you thought about having a message of depression as a disease versus depression as a brain disease, and seeing that difference.
That's a great question. I would have loved to have had more conditions, especially like that for those reasons. I think just taking the brain out, it would still have the medical model attached to it, a message like depression is a disease. I think that's similar enough to the controls with a experimental message. I wouldn't expect too much difference. But I'm not sure what else to do. I've been asked before when presenting with data about using like Alzheimer's or heart disease or comparing it to another disorder. We did really just want to take away
The slogan about healing brain disease was developed by a generation that was working with family members that had severe mental health symptoms, and this is the best way that they could see to explain it. So if you took your cohort with 20-year-olds, right? So you did it with, let's say we could do it with 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds, and we could see how it changed
by cohort
and by experience, and then you kind of correlate it with my experience with family mental health symptoms. You could see maybe, and you could show NAMI that this might be the perfect message for a certain cohort of people. But for people that are younger and with different experiences with mental health and the stigma, it might be the wrong. And that might be an interesting way of pitching it, because it's a little more of a follow-up.
It really would. And the trouble is, you see, it's part of the billboard. The billboard could reach everybody.
Very ingrained stigmatizing attitudes in 11-year-olds.
figure out where you can place those learning books. It's so exciting.
Yeah, the entertainment industry, the Entertainment Industry Council just did a really amazing study that I think that they hope to publish. But I can give you a few tidbits on it that we found in Spanish language media here in the States that almost the entire number of articles that were written that had the word mental illness in it were a negative portrayal. And in English language, it wasn't doing that much better, but at least it was less than a majority. And in English language reporting, there at least were like links and resources, here's how you find help. They may not have a positive portrayal or a positive story, but they were willing to direct the reader to a resource. So we have a lot of work to do. So after year one and looking at all of our baseline and assessment, we're kind of working with all of our 25 contractors and saying, where do we need to shift some of our energy? And definitely one of the things that we've learned is Spanish language media, we really want to focus on giving them the tools that they can have, and also to do a lot of outreach into the community so that we're working with the appropriate partners to kind of really start looking at how stigma is uniquely experienced in underserved communities. And we can start that work, and there is, 25 years of work that needs to be done, but our role, again, like I mentioned, is really to hopefully launch some seeds of change, provide some tools for people all over California to use these things later.
Amazing. Any other questions? Okay. Yeah, one more. Go ahead.
I was just going to suggest and say that the year presentation with the Spruce Street was fascinating and really great. If you were to do that again, I would suggest taking a sentence that's parallel and also that's also referring to an illness that's serious, like diabetes or high blood pressure or something, that has the same kind of life implications, and saying, this disease is a blood disease, or this disease is diabetes, is a sugar-related disease, something like that, so it would have stigma, non-stigma, to see with something that has parallel implications for being serious and life affected. If the one has the more negative, because otherwise I think it can be hard to separate out the type of affect.
Absolutely. Yeah, we went around and around and around with this in several settings. This is obviously what we ended up with. I would love to do what you're saying, given the chance to do it again and see what it would be different. I kind of wonder why we went the way we did at the time. I'm afraid of bringing up, I think every disease has some sort of affective component to it, but it still would be interesting to have that baseline and see if the stigma would lift it above that as well.
Thank you, everyone.
kinds of patients who get better, it depends on how many of these criteria they're meeting and how severe they are, and the protocol that you're
Yeah. So it's kind of a rare community. Yeah. So they're trying. session too. So I was just following up with the peers and the non-therapists being able to provide support
well,
to get a good diagnosis.
Yeah, that's the whole.
Loving that.
Who opened the door really nicely.
Clinicians clearly don't agree. I mean, I've been to the two conferences that exist in borderline personality disorder, the vast majority of presentations are actually infighting about what it really is, which indicates to me that the experts don't know.
Well, then, I work in the public mental health system, and I ran a training. I know a lot of client leaders in California. And as you probably know, that if you're an adult, you have severe mental health issues and a lot of talent and a lot of stuff going on, you get all the diagnoses.
Mm-hmm.
With like 15 year period, you can get four major ones.
Oh, yeah.
Many people get borderline personality disorder and paranoid schizophrenia. And you know, it goes on and on. So, what does it mean? I don't know. So, people like you can kind of, in a gentle, careful way, capture these. Things that don't make sense, contradictions, and kind of start to open doors, and then maybe go to conferences where people are questioning, and start to lay the groundwork. This isn't a diagnosis, this is a set of systems.
And patients report different patterns than what clinicians report. Most of the patients I interviewed said, first I was labeled as ADHD, then I was labeled as spider patient, and then I was borderline. And I mean,
bipolar is an issue,
right. So first the ADHD drugs are tried, and then the bipolar disorder drugs are tried, and then when neither of those are effective, then they're like, okay, well, I guess maybe you really have this personality.
Are you guys in the medical section?
Yes, I work with Kathleen Thomas.
Oh, you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.